supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Between Bill Cosby's first criminal trial and his second, now underway in Norristown, is the judge is allowing up to five additional women who accused him of sexual assault to testify. Today, jurors heard from the first. WHYY's Laura Benchoff has more from the Montgomery County Courthouse.
Heidi Thomas is a music teacher in Colorado. She was an aspiring actress in musical theater in 1984 when she says Cosby reached out to her agent seeking a meeting. On the witness stand today, she testified that Cosby offered her mentorship, but instead drugged her and sexually assaulted her at a home outside Reno, Nevada. Thomas is one of up to five women the prosecution can call to try to show that Cosby had a criminal pattern of behavior. The complainant in the trial, Andrea Constand, says Cosby drugged and assaulted her at his mansion in Cheltenham back in 2004. Earlier in the day, during opening arguments, Cosby's lawyers called Constand a, quote, con man who was out for Cosby's money. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
The family of a University of Pennsylvania student who died by suicide is suing the school for not doing enough to prevent their daughter's death. The lawsuit filed today alleges that staff failed to take necessary action after Olivia Kong told personnel in the counseling center several times that she was thinking about killing herself. For WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Joel Wolfram reports.
The suit was filed a day before the two-year anniversary of Kong's death on April 11, 2016. Lawyer Carol Nelson Shepherd is representing Kong's parents. She says the family is filing the suit to get the university to take responsibility for her daughter's death and address what they say are systemic problems in dealing with mental health crises on campus.
To shine a light on the really dreadful job that one of our most elite local institutions, the University of Pennsylvania, has done on the critical issue of student suicide.
The suit alleges that Kong told university staff several times that she was having suicidal thoughts, and on two occasions told counselors directly that she had thought about specific plans for following through with it. Kong had two phone conversations with one staff psychiatrist in which she said she was having suicidal thoughts. The second call was just 2 days before she died. The suit cites medical records saying she told the psychiatrist that she would be returning to campus the next day to kill herself.
He took no steps to provide any kind of in-person evaluation, any kind of treatment or medications. He did not say, I'm going to send an ambulance, we're going to pick you up, and we're going to take you to the ER.
Lawyers for the Kong family say that 14 students have committed suicide on Penn's campus since 2013. Kong's parents said in a statement that the university, quote, did not have a structure and procedures in place to prevent this tragic outcome. A Penn spokesman declined to comment, saying the university typically doesn't comment on pending litigation. For WHYY, Joel Wolfram.
Pennsylvania will elect a governor this year, and while Democratic incumbent Tom Wolf is unopposed in the May 15th party primary, three Republican candidates are in a heated contest to win the right to challenge Wolf in the November general election. Today, we'll feature the first of our interviews with the Republican candidates. Laura Ellsworth is a 59-year-old attorney from Pittsburgh. She spent 30 years at the international law firm of Jones Day, though she's better known for her civic work in what's often referred to as the Pittsburgh Renaissance. She headed the Chamber of Commerce and played important roles in the United Way and the Allegheny Conference on Community Development. She spoke with WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies.
Laura Ellsworth, welcome to Newsworks tonight. The state has a huge budget deficit. Can you fix that without raising taxes? What's a key element of this?
A key element of it is growing the business base laterally, creating an environment where businesses that are already here want to grow and expand, and more importantly, businesses that aren't here want to come and contribute to the tax base. If we grow the tax base laterally by bringing new businesses and new taxpayers, we can get ourselves out of this problem. That business growth coupled with more fiscal discipline than we've seen, those two things together will absolutely get us out of this crisis.
Is there a particular program, though, that you think is inefficient or can be cut to save a lot of money? Because the numbers are pretty big here.
They are. I think one of them is DEP and DOT. I think those are organizations that have—
Environmental Protection and yes. Department of Transportation.
Yes. Yeah. I think these are departments that have grown into silos because as different programs have come along, different divisions and departments were formed. There is now a huge amount of replication. There's a huge amount of siloed activity that could be done much more effectively and efficiently. One of the other things that I think could really be done is to invest in technology. Just about every department up there is using technology from the 60s and 70s. We need to fix that so that all of these departments can work more effectively and efficiently.
Do Pennsylvania schools need more money?
I think we have made a mistake by conflating more money with success. I think we believe, as I see this governor, that throwing more money at a problem solves it. And I think sometimes the reverse is true. It makes us feel good about ourselves, but we're not doing the really heavy lifting that we need to do to improve outcomes for children. So I think where we need to focus on education is on our children and meeting our children where we find them, delivering diverse educational experiences so that every child can learn in the way he or she learns best. And not all children learn the same. You know that from your own children, right? Our different children learn differently. We need to put the children first.
Is there one specific way that we can do that?
I think we can allow diversity of schools and more school choice for parents.
Do we need any new regulations on guns?
I think we have right now the 1995 gun law, as you well know, provides, if enforced adequately, provides an opportunity to keep guns, weapons out of the hands of dangerously mentally ill people that I think everybody agrees we need to do. I think one additional regulation I would like to see is more centralized reporting. And I would also like to see a regulation that if there is a report that is received relative to a school, that the school be immediately notified of that threat, not waiting to see whether somebody does or does not get around to investigating it. The minute that comes in, the school should at least be notified.
What about automatic weapons? I mean, do people need to have military weapons? Bump stocks, too.
I'll answer the question separately. I do not think – I have been on record as saying I think bump stocks, accessories that convert weapons into something else should be regulated, and I believe that they should. There is, in Pennsylvania, as you know, two Second Amendments. There is the federal Second Amendment that applies, and there is also a state Second Amendment. The state Second Amendment is broader in this respect. It says that the right of citizens to bear arms for their own defense and in defense of the state shall not be questioned. I read those as saying what people use for their own defense, but also in defense of the state. I read that as being broader than the guns that people might use for recreation. I believe that the Constitution speaks to both of those classes of guns, and I believe that we have to understand that we are dealing with a constitutional issue when we talk about where government can regulate in that kind of a situation.
Well, to defend the state, you might want to have bazookas, tanks, 50-caliber machine guns.
I think there is reasonable regulation that comes in on any constitutional amendment. We've seen it in the Second Amendment and in other things, too. But I do believe that that constitutional amendment has to be the starting place.
What about the issues of around abortion rights? Would you have, for example, supported the law that Governor Wolf vetoed in December, which would have imposed new restrictions on abortion in the state?
SB3, which would have changed the period within which you can get an elective abortion and moved it back to 20 weeks, I would support that.
Why?
Because I, as a personal matter, I am a right-to-life person. I was an advanced age mother and saw my son's heartbeat at a very young age. And so that was very profoundly impactful to me. And so as a personal view, that is my frame of reference. I believe that moving the rule back to 20 weeks is constitutional because I think fundamentally, I think for everybody, the quandary is largely based on the viability of a child. And I think that when science moves the viability of a child back to 20 weeks, if a child can reasonably survive outside of its mother, we ought not take its life.
Laura Ellsworth, thanks so much for being on Newsworks tonight.
I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Pennsylvania Republican gubernatorial candidate Laura Ellsworth speaking with WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. You can hear Ellsworth's take on campaign finance, gerrymandering, and women in politics at WHYY.org. We've also extended invitations to the other two GOP hopefuls, State Senator Scott Wagner, and businessman Paul Mango. Well, if you want a public record in New Jersey, all you've got to do is ask. That includes police body camera footage, public contracts, even emails sent by government officials. But sometimes the record keepers say no and deny your request. That's what the New Jersey Government Records Council is for, those whose public record requests get denied and want to appeal. Yet, as WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, the council is not the public records referee it's made out to be.
It's Valentine's Day 2016, and Mary Sadracula's phone rings.
It was a cold, bitter cold weekend, and I received calls from people that the trees, the beautiful trees in front of one of our elementary schools, were being cut down.
Sadracula is a former Clifton, New Jersey councilwoman and a self-described tree hugger. She jumps in her car and races down to the school.
It just was such a majestic setting because next to the school is a wooded area where sometimes we see deer and wildlife, and I was appalled.
Sadracula wanted to publicly oppose the cutting of those trees, but first she needed to get her hands on the Clifton Board of Education's contract with Rich's Tree Service. She called the school, but they said she couldn't see the contract. Then she called the assistant superintendent, who said she'd be able to see a copy. But when Sadracula got to the school board office, she says officials refused to let her have a copy of the contract or take a picture of it. She said an office worker even tore up a copy of the tree cutting contract right in front of her. Clifton officials say that part never happened. The reason Sadracula wanted the contract that day was so she could speak about it at the school board meeting the day after. Officials refused, saying they needed permission from their legal department, so Sadracula filed a complaint with the New Jersey Government Records Council, saying Clifton education officials violated the state's Open Public Records Act. She enlisted the help of an attorney, filed the appeal, and then waited. And waited.
I don't believe in our wildest dreams we thought it could take over 2 years.
Sadracula's case is one of about 350 complaints the Government Records Council is working on. A review of the council's internal tracking system shows it has a backlog going back to 2014. That means some cases have been tied up for as many as 4 years without a resolution. Public records advocates and residents say the lengthy waiting period is ironic at an agency that's supposed to be dedicated to making the government more accountable.
So in this case, justice delayed sort of is justice denied.
That's John Paff, a prolific New Jersey records requester.
It was supposed to be free, it was supposed to be easy, and it was supposed to be quick. It is free, and it is fairly easy. It's not quick.
The backlog at the GRC comes amid a decline in the council's staff and budget. This year, it got $480,000 in state funding, close to the lowest level it's ever received. The council also lists only 4 staffers on its website, down from as many as 9 in the past. A spokeswoman for the Department of Community Affairs, which houses the Government Records Council, declined our request for an interview. She said first they have to fill the position of executive director, which has been open for 4 months. The problems at the council have caught the attention of lawmakers like State Senate Majority Leader Loretta Weinberg. What does she think is causing the delays at the GRC?
Understaffing and underfunding.
Weinberg says the previous administration of Republican Governor Chris Christie didn't put enough money or manpower into the council for it to work well. But the Democrat also thinks the council is too complex and bureaucratic for the average person. Weinberg says that was the impression she got after going to a GRC meeting herself.
You actually couldn't tell what was going on from the agenda.
Weinberg is working on legislation to update the Open Public Records Act and overhaul the Government Records Council. She's considering expanding the number of council members, increasing the body's funding, or getting rid of it altogether. For now, though, that's little comfort to people like Mary Sadracula, who received a copy of the tree-cutting contract after the school board meeting. Last month, the Government Records Council finally ruled on her complaint more than 2 years after she filed it. And she lost. The council said the Clifton Board of Education didn't violate the law because they gave Sadracula the contract, even though it was a few days after her request. Contracts are immediate access records, which means officials are supposed to make them public as quickly as possible. Now, you might be thinking, what's the big deal? It's just a tree-cutting contract. To Sadra Kula, this is an example of bad government. And she says when the Government Records Council drags its feet in sorting out these complaints, the public loses.
It takes forever to get anything done. And that just allows corruption to continue and breed and grow.
From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
The Friend in Residence program concludes this Saturday at Haverford College with a performance, and joining me now is playwright and performer Mary Tuominen. Mary, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
We'll get to the upcoming performance, but first describe the residence program at Haverford College.
So about a year ago, I had a play called Peaceable Kingdom that was premiered here in Philadelphia, and it had Quaker themes. It was about this painting by Edward Hicks called Peaceable Kingdom, where you see lions and lambs laying down together, and in the background is William Penn and Chief Tamenend of the Lenape people creating the Treaty of Shackamaxon. And this Quaker really believed that Philadelphia was an example of utopia, would be an example of lions and lambs laying together, making the beautiful new world, creating the revolution. And I thought, well, that's a really funny subject for a play. And so I had a bunch of lions and lambs and goats and leopards on stage having Quaker meeting together and really figuring out the big questions of existence. So I've been investigating questions like that with the students at Haverford, questions of social justice and art, and what does it mean to make political art in this particular moment, and what does it mean in the larger historical context, and where are we, and how do we create narratives of resistance in our times?
And that discourse began actually a couple of months back. And so what are some of the takeaways in interacting with students, faculty?
It's been interesting. We looked a lot at this poem called 38 by Lely Long Soldier about the Lakota 38 who were executed by Abraham Lincoln. And she explains the execution in these very simple steps in a way that you can really understand what occurred. But it's so difficult to talk about anything having to do with America and American history that it's almost impossible to explain even a simple thing of like, this is why these 38 people were executed. And so that feeling of like we're on a switchback trail, we're trying to explain our own context, we're trying to explain our own history, how do I even orient myself in this historical moment, has been a lot of the questions that the students have been wrestling with. And the students come from all different backgrounds and struggle with different ideas of diaspora and different ideas of context. And it's been really beautiful and interesting to hear them investigate that.
How is that struggle playing out internally for you, especially in 2018?
Well, in 2014, I wrote this piece, Hello Sadness. It was in the wake of the Trayvon Martin verdict and all these things, and it was a real moment of darkness for me as far as figuring out how to enact social justice in my times. And people saw that piece in that year, and they were like, huh, she seems really mad. We're not sure why. And then I re-premiered it last year in 2017 at Fringe Arts, and everyone was like, oh, we're on board. It was the night of the travel ban was the last performance of it, and everyone thought, this is so pertinent. And so it's been interesting, actually, to see how work that I've been thinking about for a few years now actually is having a very good moment in 2018. And more people are actually woke than usual. And I think we are in an excellent moment for art and social justice and how to give everyone space for the multiplicity of perspectives that we will need in order to create a rich and full idea of what a country can be as we move into these critical times, I think is essential. And I think art can do that.
How will that moment manifest itself this Saturday with a performance entitled This Is On Record?
So I'm part of a company called Applied Mechanics, and we have been working on this idea of media and cultural narrative for a few years now. We are creating a piece that involves characters in 1968, so we're now on the 50th anniversary of King's assassination, and in 1982 and in 2014. And all of these characters in different ways are society's documenters. Either they're radio broadcasters or they are writing children's books. So there are many different ways in which cultural narrative gets documented in ways that often don't occur to you. And it's an immersive piece, so the audience is part of it and they walk through it and they affect the action often. And so we have been making immersive pieces like this that hold a multiplicity of perspective, that hold different opinions, and every audience member gets a different journey through the piece. No two people see this exact same thing. You can walk wherever you want. You can be part of an intimate party with just one character. Maybe you're the only audience member that sees a certain thing. And we are trying to create art that acts like the utopia we want, where there is no one narrative, where everyone has their own experience, and that is valid and held, and there is space for it.
Mary, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Playwright and performer Mary Tuominen. Later this month, another Philadelphia playwright will also be busy. Michael Hollinger will have two of his plays produced by two different companies occupying the same building. During simultaneous rehearsals, Hollinger has been literally bouncing between comedy and drama, as WHYY's Peter Crimmins explains.
Michael Hollinger is a well-established playwright in town. He teaches at Villanova University. He likes to put comedy in his dramas and drama in his comedies.
In the plays that I write that are dramas, I always am working in laughter to figure out where can the laughs happen. And with the comedies, always figuring out, now that I've gotten an audience to laugh, where is that moment of truth or poignancy that is really going to strike to the core?
In a former Catholic school building in South Philadelphia, 1812 Productions is rehearsing Hollinger's script, Hope and Gravity. It's a play involving many disjointed scenes held together by a network of interrelated characters and an elevator accident. About midway through rehearsal, Hollinger leaves.
I feel a little like a bigamist at the moment because I'm moving between these very personal projects that mean a lot to me. And yet, you know, I'm saying, okay, well, I'll see you tomorrow. I have to go upstairs to my other wife.
Upstairs, Hollinger delivers 8 new pages he just wrote to Theater Exile, which is about to premiere his new play, Sing the Body Electric. It's about how people's lives change after a lightning strike.
Really, who have you helped?
What?
Name one person.
I can't reveal.
Because there aren't any.
No.
Sing the Body Electric by Theater Exile opens April 19th. 1812 Productions' Hope and Gravity opens the 26th. The two plays have nothing to do with one another. They were written years apart with totally different characters and stories. But rehearsing them simultaneously has made Hollinger realize that he tends to write about people scarred by life, and his work depends on actors being in the same room with the audience.
Which is, of course, what's most special about live theater, that it's not on a screen, it's not in a can, you can't rewind it. It's happening now between these people and these bodies. And that's something that's, I think, becoming more central to my work.
These Hollinger plays are just 2 of 4 being produced this season in the region. Hollinger jokes that he must have a fatal disease no one told him about, and local theaters must have decided to give him a big send-off. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.